by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program today, the story of the mutiny on the Bounty. Our guest is writer Caroline Alexander. She's the author of the best-selling and critically acclaimed book, The Bounty, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Bounty. The New York Times said of this book, "A sea mist hangs over this age-old tale. Alexander dispels it to the reader's fascination." The Times named the book one of the best of 2003. Caroline Alexander tells readers in this book that the story of the Bounty that generation after generation has been told is not true. Captain Bligh was not the tyrannical captain he's been made out to be, and Fletcher Christian, not the hero he's been made out to be. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Caroline Alexander. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Caroline Alexander is the author of The Endurance, the best-selling book about the expedition of Ernest Shackleton to the Antarctic. She also wrote and co-produced the award-winning documentary, The Endurance. She's written four other nonfiction books, and her articles have appeared in many magazines, including The New Yorker and Smithsonian. Her latest book, The Bounty, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Bounty, is now available in a paperback edition from Penguin. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Caroline Alexander, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, thank you.
When and how did you become interested in revisiting this story of the Bounty?
Well, it directly evolved from the previous work, which you mentioned, The Endurance, which is an Antarctic survival story. But at the heart of this remarkable saga is a great open boat voyage. And when I was researching the first book, The Endurance, I kept sort of running up against these superlatives that would describe the Shackleton's great boat voyage as the first or second greatest boat voyage ever made. And so I became very interested in what might be the contender, and the contending voyage was that conducted by William Bligh, young Lieutenant William Bligh, by the way, not
yes.
Captain Bligh, as he then was, after the mutiny on the Bounty, when he and some of his men were dumped in a very small boat in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the story so many generations have been told or read or seen in the movies, you know, it's a ripping good story. And perhaps now we should call it a good yarn. When did the version of the story we all know, when did that begin?
Alarmingly early, and one of the most sort of sinister and, if you will, enlightening parts of the true story is the method in is first of all, I suppose one becomes aware of how early the phenomena of spin really is. What was at heart was the life at first and then the professional career of a young midshipman who was amongst the mutineers and brought back to England and brought to stand court-martial. And his fate really affected the whole dynamics of what would become the later story, because as it turned out, he had the good fortune of being related to extremely well-placed people in the British Navy, including a man who was arguably the highest naval figure in the kingdom, a person named Admiral Lord Richard Howe. And this had been unknown. It was certainly known that young Heywood enjoyed certain connections, but the extent to which they were there had not been known. And what happened is that you see this young man who's found guilty before the court-martial of mutiny, but then pardoned. So that was the first victory that the family lobby, if you will, pulled off, which was that they saved his neck. But now they also had to rehabilitate him. And it's not a good career step to be a pardoned mutineer if you wish to embark on a long and illustrious career in the Royal Navy. So they had to finesse what this term mutiny meant. And what they ended up doing, and I part of this was done cold-bloodedly, part of it was done with the kind of passion that any family, I think, would genuinely bring to a member of their family who was in trouble, where you just sort of lose all perspective of what's right and wrong, and you just go for what's going to help the person at stake. So it isn't all quite as cold-blooded as it might seem, but the end result was a story version that was woven while William Bligh was out of the country, in which they declared for the first time in British naval history that the mutiny had been justified. And the reason it had been justified, they now put forward, was that the captain was so tyrannical. And so this way they adroitly massaged the story and made the villains the heroes and the hero the villain. And the only thing that's really worth noting is that the charges made against Bligh were not yet at this stage anything to do with the physical brutality that became part of the later legend. He was just accused of being a sort of ungentlemanly chap who had a harsh tongue. But it made a very effective story, and when Bligh returned from overseas, he found that he met with a very cold reception from the Admiralty. So the story could be said to have been woven well within his lifetime and well within the aftermath of the Bounty, and then it just got more and more detailed and elaborated as time went on until we get Charles Laughton, if you will.
Yeah, over the top. I have a listener waiting to talk with us, and I want to get to that caller in just a second here. But before I do that, I want to ask you about the impact that this spin had on William Bligh during his lifetime. And did Peter Heywood suffer any shame, any sense of guilt over what he had done?
First question, how did the sort of the story, if you will, the fabricated story of the Mutiny Bounty affect William Bligh? It did affect him very gravely. It didn't entirely cripple his career. He went on to be a vice admiral of the Blue, which meant that he rose to the ranks in the manner that readers familiar with Patrick O'Brien will know, which is that when someone above you dies, you get to move up. But he certainly was, commissions and ships came to him, it seems, very slowly. And a lot of what made for a stellar career in those times was being given the sort of right ship for the right campaign. And immediately after the Bounty, first of all, he had to wait 18 months for a single commission. And this is at a time, by the way, when Britain is at war, engaged in the Napoleonic Wars, which makes it all the more inexplicable. And then the ships tended to be lumbering old, future prizes of enemies in a way. Bligh always did a good job with the hand that he was served. He was a consummate seaman, very professional, and so he continued on with his career and ended up being the governor of New South Wales, which was Australia effectively was called in those days. And he had trouble there, but he was sort of honorably discharged, as it were, at the end of his life. So he could look back on his life and say with satisfaction, I did my duty, I acquitted myself well. But if one looks at it from a historian's point of view, one would have expected William Bligh to have been knighted, for example, for any number of things that he did. So his wings were clipped, that much is sure. I don't think it crippled him, but it certainly didn't allow him to soar. In terms of Peter Heywood, who's the young gentleman in question who had the good fortune of all these well-placed relatives, he, when he was given his pardon, he was told to sort of submit, as it were, his, it was a pardon, it wasn't a verdict of not guilty, and therefore it came with certain advisory conditions, you know, namely, never forget this day and remember that your duty lies to your sovereign. And there's a great deal of evidence about Peter Heywood's spirituality. He was a very religious young man, and he became much more religious when he was in the in irons and the hold of a ship awaiting trial for his life. And that never left him. He came out sort of very spiritually committed, if you will. And one has a very keen sense that his life was one thwarted, or stunted, perhaps is a better word, by guilt and yearning and regret. He had a very decent, straightforward career. He returned out to be a remarkable draftsman, which he did some beautifully fine maps, for example. He was well-placed socially. He did very well. But there are letters where he, for example, writes of a yearning to return to Tahiti and interest when the mutineers of the Bounty were, or the descendants were discovered years and years and years later. On Pitcairn Island, he sort of writes wistfully, oh, you know, you can tell he would just love an excuse to be able to sort of run off and see what it was all about. And all of these passions he sort of damped down and just led the life of a proper English gentleman. And yet this was a man who had, as a young boy, well, not boy, young man of 17, 18, 19, lived with a Tahitian woman. By his own account, had children there, although we've never found any trace of them, and had tattooed himself like a Tahitian and spoke the language perfectly fluently. So this was a man who'd left his heart on the island that he never got to go back to.
Mm. Let's talk with this listener who's waiting to talk with us this afternoon. Join in the discussion. A caller in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hello. I enjoyed very much the Shackleton adventure, and I don't have much to say except I'm going to go out and get the book and read about the real story. What might not be in the book is commentary on, I think it may be two movies that came out on this myth, one not too long ago. Yeah, and I'll just continue listening and enjoying your comments.
There are actually, believe it or not, five movies on the Mutiny on the Bounty. Two I myself have not seen, although I'm trying to arrange to do so through sort of film archive in New York. Two were silent films, and the first one, second, starred Errol Flynn as Fletcher Christian in his first starring role. So that would be worth seeing for that reason alone. Then the sort of more mainstream films are the famous Charles Laughton and Clark Gable, and I think Charles Laughton forever remains the bligh of legend, if you will. That he's hard to surpass for sheer evilness. And then we had the second film, which I think was Trevor Howard and Marlon Brando doing a weird, very personal, I guess you'd say, inspired take on who Fletcher Christian was. And then the final one was Mel Gibson and Anthony Hopkins as William Bly. And the latter one, in a way, is the truest to the reality in that it's shaded, at least. You know, Bly is not wholly evil, and Christian is not wholly good. But there's still, at the end of the day, Fletcher Christian is the hero. And it's always going to be Hollywood's most glamorous, romantic, handsome leading man who's going to get the role of Fletcher Christian, I fear.
Yeah. Do you think we'll see some new treatments of this story in novel form and in film?
Well, it's hard to tell. It's I've had interest on the film front, but having been involved in some films myself, I have very much a kind of caustic wait-and-see attitude about that. It's a certainly more complicated and subtle story, which may be seen as a strong point or may very well be perceived as a weak point. That's hard to judge. I certainly think that there are, when the entire story is laid out, there are so many fascinating sub-stories and themes that would bear perhaps, in its day, it inspired a great deal of long poetry, for example. It's always spawned other forms of literature. But I certainly could see dramatizations, not necessarily on film, or novelizations of some of the sub-themes. When I first approach the story. I was not sort of set out to redeem. I did not set out to redeem William Bly or to write a kind of revisionist history. What became apparent to me at a very early stage was that this was a vast story, that it involved not just the going out, the voyage out to Tahiti, the period on Tahiti, the voyage home from Tahiti, the mutiny, but that was almost a prelude to what could be regarded as an equally dramatic story. And the dramatic story is the capture of the mutineers, bringing them back to England, in which they have a shipwreck of their own, and an extraordinary saga in its own right. The whole period of waiting for this court-martial to take place, while they're all kept in irons in Portsmouth Harbor in the gunroom of a ship, a period that is documented very, very amply by the fact that Peter Heywood's sister kept an album of every letter that she wrote on her brother's behalf or wrote to him, and that he wrote back to her or other people wrote to her. So you have this extraordinary spread of letters that span several months on almost a daily basis, and we can monitor virtually day by day what Peter Heywood was thinking or what was being done on his behalf. So that period of waiting, which one might have normally been tempted to sort of gloss over or blip over, suddenly unfolds as a chapter where you get enormously interesting and varied voices that come in. Some of the very few female voices, for one thing, with the appearance of Peter Heywood's insufferable sister Nessie. And then you have the actual sentencing and execution of some of the men, which is well documented. And then what always appeals to me in any work of this kind, as was the case with The Endurance, is what happens to the men after the defining event of their life. I'm fascinated by the backside of history. You've survived an open boat voyage, or you've survived a mutiny, or you've lived in Tahiti. You're known as Bly of the Bounty, or your young Peter Heywood, who's now tattooed for the rest of his life from head to toe virtually and fluent in Tahitian, but he's got to live the next 40 years almost in England as a professional naval officer. So how do you do that, and what happens? So I try to follow out as many stories of as many men, not just the name, those with name recognition, but all the crew of the Bounty became the objects of my attention. So once you spread this whole story out, you've got a different story, and that's how the revision came. But I think that anybody else looking in on this who was interested in dramatic possibility or just novelization or inspiration could choose a little thread from this whole messy range and find something to sort of, dig into.
Yeah. I think the problem is that Hollywood in general, speaking in general terms, likes things neat and tidy, and they like a hero. And that might be problematic.
Bly is the hero, and he's certainly not a glamorous hero.
There you go.
That means that you've already limited the possibilities.
Yeah, yeah. You would call Bly a hero?
Very much so. I mean, the fact remains, the thing that drew me to this story was the fact that somehow Lieutenant William Bly had got his name, if you will, in the archives of great maritime achievement. And you'll talk to many, many people of the sea, either in naval professions on either side of the Atlantic or maritime historians, who absolutely rate Bly's accomplishment of steering that open boat in the Pacific for 3,600 miles with no maps and on starvation rations as one of the great feats of seamanship that has never been surpassed. So in many people's eyes, he always was a hero. And there were many people who thought so highly of that accomplishment that they were really unconcerned with the detail of how or why the mutiny happened. And once one bears down on who he really was and how and why the mutiny really happened and who the players were, there's no dark stain on William Bly's character. He was somebody, I think, who was dealt a very bad hand with the whole Bounty voyage. And it's you know, an interesting question whether it would have happened under anybody in the world. But certainly Fletcher Christian was the problem, not William Bly.
Mm. Well, we'll talk about Fletcher Christian here in just a moment. Let's talk with a listener waiting on line one, a caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. Do you have any information on the inhabitants of Pitcairn Island? I've heard that there were congenital anomalies as a result of the inbreeding, and I will hang up and listen.
There's quite a bit of Pitcairn Island has been an object of fascination by many people, historians and anthropologists and even linguists. What happened, for people who are not familiar with the story, is that when Fletcher Christian escaped, Fletcher Christian was not one of the mutineers who was captured and brought to trial. So he escapes off into the Blue Pacific with eight companions. And the men kidnap, very much against their will, a group of Tahitian women. The romantic telling of the story was always that these women, you know, were their lovers or wives, but that is untrue. And then they go off looking for a place to settle where no one will find them. And they end up finding a remote island in the Pacific, which had been wrongly placed on charts, which made it even more undetectable, called Pitcairn's Island. And to this day, the population of Pitcairn Island is very distinct in that it is, you know, it's a virtually closed community. There have been, over the years, one or two interlopers who were not from the founding families, a few missionaries who came, a teacher who came. But nonetheless, even they came at rather an early time, so that you are correct in saying that there's a very limited gene pool. I don't know about, I haven't heard any report of what you'd call defects. My guess is that it's no different than going into the certain parts of the Appalachian Mountains, for example. You've certainly got the problem of a small population. You've had some new people coming into it. But the people, you know, tend to, what's interesting is how they've organized their life in this kind of Anglo-Polynesian way. And the women were very much the people who were, in some sense, the backbone of survival of the early community, because it was they who knew what foods you eat, how you prepare them, how you make clothing out of bark cloth, all the things that would be necessary for survival. And so the women have traditionally, you know, been very central to the community. That being said, at this moment, very sadly, the large portion of the Pitcairn Island male population is about to go on trial for sex crimes. And this is a case that will be tried in the upcoming months under the jurisdiction of the New Zealand courts. And the reason for this is that very young girls seem to have been, you know, sexually used. And the only, if you will, interesting fact of this rather unhappy story is that it seems to be almost a kind of conflict between Western values and traditional old Polynesian values, in which young girls did come of age and were perceived and saw themselves as coming of age at a very, very young age. And so, ironically, it's the women's traditions, the Tahitian women's traditions, that have led to this, you know, unpleasant reality. So it may be that you'll be reading more about Pitcairn Island in the months ahead than has been the case in the past.
Hmm. Caroline Alexander is our guest this afternoon. Her latest book, The Bounty, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Bounty, was chosen as one of the 9 best books of the year last year by the editors of the New York Times Book Review. It's now out in paperback from Penguin. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, what would you like us to know about Fletcher Christian?
Well, he's an interesting character. You know, none of these characters were all good or all bad. And by suggesting that Bly was not the villain and Fletcher Christian was not the hero was not to say that Fletcher Christian was, if you will, a bad person. First of all, by way of background, Fletcher Christian came from one of these families in England that can trace their name back literally 1,000 years and were very proud to do so on the one hand, but on the other hand were utterly bankrupt. And yet somehow their pretensions or illusions had not kept pace with their fading fortune. So you have this sort of sense of entitlement that was wholly out of whack with the realities of their reduced circumstances. And when Fletcher Christian was a young boy, his father died, and his mother, who had been bailed out by her family on two previous occasions for bankruptcy, finally succumbed to total bankruptcy and had to flee from England to the Isle of Man so that she would not be put into debtor's prison. So young Fletcher Christian grew up both with this sort of sense of being a Christian, with this old, ancient, and honorable name on the one hand, and absolutely no livelihood whatsoever on the other hand. And William Bly had been an early patron of Fletcher Christian because William Bly was married to a woman from the Isle of Man, which was a very small community. So Fletcher Christian and William Bly had sailed together in the merchant service on two previous trips prior to going on the mutiny on the Bounty, and they had sailed, you know, in a professional relationship with Bly as the commanding officer and Fletcher Christian as a junior, very much junior subordinate. So the two men should have known each other fairly well, and we get sort of glimpses of Christian through a remarkable manuscript discovered by a descendant of Fletcher Christian, who found in a country home in England, I think under the grand piano, a box of papers in which, amongst the papers, was an unpublished autobiography by one of Fletcher Christian's brothers. And in this, we learn some amazing things. We learn, for example, that Fletcher Christian's brother had been involved in a mutiny just before the Bounty sailed, and that had met with Fletcher, and the two men had, you know, spent an evening together just before Fletcher had to leave with the Bounty. So the last home story Fletcher Christian left England with was the story from his very agitated brother about how he'd had to stand up against a tyrannical captain. And I believe that very much started haunting him and affected him when he was in Tahiti. We also know that Fletcher Christian borrowed money from William Bly, and this was something that, according to other members of the crew at many, many years later, was something that when William Bly lost his temper at Christian, he would always bring up. So the kind of, you know, nagging that would be irritating in any circumstance, but on a very small ship at the end of the earth, probably more irritating than at other times. So you see a picture of two men starting to wear a bit on each other. And I believe really truly that all that happened, according to, we have many, many accounts from the people on deck at the time and during the night before of what happened. It appears that Fletcher Christian was yelled at by William Bly, and actually quite rightly so, for a dereliction of duty in some respect, and that he just snapped. And he'd been 5 months in Tahiti, living on land, living as a lord almost, and now came the difficult task of sailing this miserably small little ship back to England. To what? You know, to a bankrupt family, to his brother maybe, for all he knew, in prison or dead for mutiny. And I think suddenly, just at that one moment, he'd been up drinking the night before the day of the mutiny, and I think he was just not in his senses. And there's a very poignant comment made by another of Fletcher Christian's brothers, who said, had Fletcher Christian been absent from the Bounty for one day or one ill-fated hour, the mutiny wouldn't have happened. And I believe that's probably the fairest assessment of this sort of event.
How did William Bly following the mutiny, following the events that happened back in England, the trial of the mutineers. How did Bligh, you know, sometime down the line, feel about Fletcher Christian?
It's interesting. We have some correspondence between William Bligh and his patron, Sir Joseph Banks, in which some years later, not a great many years later, but in, probably not late enough for the wounds to have entirely healed, there was a rumor that Fletcher Christian had escaped. There was a fraudulent publication that was put out along the lines, perhaps, of when you said, you know, would this inspire other people to write stories about it? Someone had written a book which purported to be written by Fletcher Christian and was about his adventures after the mutiny and how he'd ended up in Spain and was now a sort of grandee, very amusing and very well done piece. And Bligh writes at that point to just Sir Joseph Banks and says, is it possible that that wretch is in Cadiz? Mm. And you can sort of see that the wounds are still very, very raw at that point. But later on, I think Bligh was sort of complacent, perhaps, enough in himself and in his view of his own professionalism that he, as he matured and got older, I think he came to regard this as some sort of tedious event that wasn't worth spending a great deal of time upon. He certainly didn't turn into somebody writing reams of pamphlets defending his honor and his name. He seemed to have just moved on. One of the things to remember is the context in which both men went to sea, which is that they were part of the Royal Navy, whose business is usually war, not sending breadfruit expeditions to Tahiti. And when Bligh got back and finally got another commission, he then took part in two very important battles of the Napoleonic Wars, the Battle of Camperdown and the Battle of Copenhagen alongside Nelson. And those events to him, to a professional naval man, would have been of far more consequence than this piddly little breadfruit expedition that went wrong. And so I think that he came to see himself as his career carried on as a professional naval man, and that this other event was in the past, but that if Fletcher Christian ever had been caught, you can bet that he would have advocated very strongly and sternly for, you know, summary judgment, as it were, and an execution, no pardon.
Yeah. One of the things that stories like this make me wonder about is just what kind of man would you like to serve under on the sea in the, you know, at this point in history? You know, what makes a good captain, and how does a captain keep the loyalty of his men?
Well, it's a very interesting question, particularly as election time is near and one starts looking at, you know, this term leadership is bandied around so much and so glibly. And it's interesting. I, after the Shackleton book, was invited to do all kinds of sort of seminars or lectures on leadership based on Shackleton's model, because that former story is usually regarded as a sort of extraordinary saga of survival by leadership. In other words, mm-hmm. how the leader made decisions, not just pragmatic decisions, but, if you will, moral or morale decisions, was what kept a unit of men who had no business surviving alive and mentally healthy as well as physically alive for all those months in the Antarctic ice. And the same can be said, really, of William Bligh. And they represent two very different styles from two very different eras. Shackleton was Irish and instinctive and psychologically very, almost diabolically manipulative, for good effect, but he knew how he had to work his men, if you will. He was also, you know, a product of Edwardian England. William Bligh was an 18th century naval professional who would not have condescended to play psychological tricks with his men and would not have condescended to them because the code at that time was so clear that duty and honor were what bound you and that you, you know, have called upon and often called upon one submitted one's life to such principles so that you had different ammunition, cruder ammunition, if you will, to work with. So the question of sort of who would one rather be with? One might rather be with an easygoing, sort of funny, fun captain in fair weather. but if what we're talking about is leadership in crisis,
yeah,
then you've really got to look at things very, very sternly. And the question comes as to who could affect your survival? Who's going to know their job well enough, be experienced well enough? I mean, that's one of the things that's so extraordinary, for example, about Bligh's great boat voyage. Again, just for people who don't know it, this was 19 men in a 23-foot-long open boat, so overloaded that there was only 7 inches of freeboard in calm weather, with food for 5 days on an ordeal that would last for 48 days. In an uncharted ocean with no maps. I mean, it's as if every part of an impossible venture that could be invented was thrown at William Bligh. And he sails this small boat, navigating himself through what's now known as the Torres Straits, cross Pacific, through the Torres Straits to Indonesia. And every man, except for one who was murdered by islanders, survives that journey. How did he do it? And one of the reasons he did it was he knew exactly what he was doing. I mean, he was a consummate navigator, consummate sailor, consummate professional, and also wholly and utterly confident. And this is what emerges again and again and again from his blog, which he keeps writing. And the only quality I found that is absolutely shared by people as disparate leaders, as disparate as Bligh and Shackleton, was a complete confidence in being able to perform their objectives. Neither of them doubted that they were going to bring their men to safety, even though the odds were impossible. And the only thing is that they were not, it wasn't blind optimism, it was more like looking into your professional base, into the marrow of your bones almost, and saying, what is it I know that I know how to do? Because whatever I know how to do, I've now got to perform, but I know I can. So it's not as frivolous as just saying, you know, hope for the best or it'll all come out well. That's not quite what it was. It was more this bone-deep professional optimism. And so in my view, I'd rather be in a small boat with an experienced naval officer.
Yeah. The men who Bligh pulled through, who survived, the loyalists, what kind of record, did they leave a record behind of their experience in that little boat?
There were several narratives that survive of the time in different forms. On the way out, for example, unbeknownst to the people who would later become detractors of Bligh, several men had written letters home from the Cape of Good Hope, giving a running account of the voyage up to a certain point, so that we had, this is before any trouble happened, so we have these wholly unprejudiced accounts, eyewitness participants' accounts of the outgoing voyage on the one hand. We have of the mutiny itself and the aftermath of the mutiny, and that would include the open boat voyage, a number of voices. One was written by the ship's master, John Fryer, who was, I think, as miserable a man as ever sailed. He was technically loyal, although it's clear that he was so disliked by the mutineers that they decided to put him into Bligh's boat come what may. So I don't even know that he could really... He survived the boat voyage, he made it, so he was loyal to that extent, but I don't think he was there by choice, but he left an account. And so that's a loyalist account. We have a long, long and very impressive narrative by James Morrison, the bosun's mate, who would later be captured and tried for mutiny. And in fact, he wrote this narrative while he was awaiting trial. So that has to be, you know, what he says is very much affected by his circumstances. And then we have other letters and other Fletcher Christian's brother, after the court-martial, tries to get together anybody who sailed on the Bounty in order to create, he was very much instrumental in creating the anti-Bly movement, and you see him bringing in people to try and interview them, whether they'd made the boat voyage or not, and so you get mixed voices there. So more voices come out than one might know. It seems so. There's a very funny story, which I believe is true. It comes from a good source that some years after the boat voyage, a friend of Bly's heard that the sailmaker, a man named Lawrence LeBogue, happened to be in the same inn or in the same area. So he made a point of going over to sort of introduce himself and see him. And so they were chatting, and he said to LeBogue, you know, what about the boat voyage or something? You must have suffered terribly from the boat voyage. They're having a glass of grog, literally. And he says, this is better than being in a boat, eh? And LeBogue says, oh, damn me, I never think about the boat. And so you have this sort of extraordinary realization that for seamen of the time, this was, you know, a fairly colorful event, but nothing to get bogged down in. Again, they all go off and fight in wars, and I think this event faded in importance to them.
Yeah. That's another thing that always amazes me about stories like this. How many men survived terrible things at sea and went on to climb aboard another boat?
Well, I think, the expectation that they would have had on joining the Navy would have been to have participated in many times in their life in actual battle. And there can be few more terrible things, from at least my personal point of view, than being in an 18th century, early 19th century naval battle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these were terrifying. You got close to enemy fire. The medical conditions were absolutely horrendous, so that if you got a limb half shattered by a cannonball coming the wrong way, you'd be taken down and have that limb amputated with no anesthetic and no antibiotics. I mean, this was part of what the deal was. So I think that the mindset with which men entered the service, and usually entered it very, very young. William Bly was on ship's books at age 6, to give you some idea, whereas Fletcher Christian first served on a ship at age 18. So there's a world of difference there, which all, I think, points to the fact that the sea had not been Fletcher Christian's, you know, first profession of choice. And so I think they expected horrendous things, and therefore, and once you finished one battle, you just waited to be assigned to another ship and go off and do something else. It wasn't as if you mustered all your energy and strength and survival skills to come safely home, and then that was it. You had to go off again, you know, decade after decade.
That's what made for that good marrow, I suppose.
I guess it's hard to beat that kind of training if that's the product that you want.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here. Briefly, though, I want you to talk with us just very briefly about the treasure trove of documents that you were able to look at. The manuscript of Fletcher Christian's brother, Peter Hayward's letters to his sister, documents you found regarding the Bounty in the British Public Records Office.
It was absolutely remarkable. The writing the book took me about a year longer than I had originally planned, and that was simply because I had misjudged how much information it was likely to have survived from 200 years ago. And a lot of things would be known to anybody superficially approaching the subject. The log of the bounty survived, two versions of it. The court-martial transcript survived, which is an amazing series of documents. You have, 10 men were tried for mutiny, and 10 men left written depositions giving an account of what they were doing during that hour of the mutiny. So you have 10 different eyewitness accounts of the mutiny on the bounty, along with cross-examination. Things like that, and the bounty muster, had always been known. And then there were a few more esoteric things that were known, but most people didn't really trouble to get to, but tended to recycle, one book that had used it. And so I made a point at very early stage that I would try to find out who anybody's name who occurred in any paper of any kind relating to my research. I was going to try and find out who that person was. And not just find out who they were, but find out, where they came from. Does their county have archives that shed light on this person or this person's family? Did they leave a will? Are there letters either in the British Museum or in the public record office or amongst the naval papers? In other words, I really tried to run like a live investigation, like a detective investigation on each and every name. And some were red herrings and some didn't yield anything. But the process, this method yielded at the end of the day an amazing amount of material. It's where I got all the kind of quirky letters that had never been seen or heard of, new letters about sightings of Fletcher Christian in England after the, after he was supposed to be dead somewhere in the South Pacific. And also, more importantly, who was related to who. And that was really what the story came to, to turn upon, was who had the connections, who was related to who. And that's where things started to suddenly you saw and you said, oh, my God, that's why.
That's
he has access
happened.
To this person, and then you have another line of to pursue. So the research carried on. The last letter that I got, which was from Edward Christian, Fletcher's brother, to William Wilberforce, the great abolitionist, I received after the galleys had been set, and we had to revise that page in order to accommodate that particular letter. That's how up to the moment the research was.
Yeah. Well, Edward Christian is an interesting story, and listeners should we'll leave it to the listeners to pick up the book and hear that story from the pages of The Bounty, the true story of the mutiny on the Bounty. He had quite a hand in the retooling of the story of the Bounty. Caroline, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Caroline Alexander is the author of The Bounty, the true story of the mutiny on the Bounty, the book now out in paperback from Penguin. It is 1:54. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the bean pit taking off a bit today. A little bit of a bounce, but mostly the idea is that the Chinese were definitely in the market for some nearby shipment of beans, and that pushed not only the nearby August contract, but the Noves and the January's up anywhere between 14.25 and 19.5 cents. The grain floor responding just a bit following the beans up. Wheat futures a high today of 3.23, a low at 3.18 in the September contract, settling at 3.21 1/2. They were up 3 cents on the day. December futures 3.36 3/4, the high, the low at 3.32, a settlement price there at 3.36, up 3.25. And the March wheat 3.48 1/2, the high, the low at 3.44 1/4, settlement price 3.48, up 3.5 cents. May futures 3.53, the high, the low at 3.49 1/4, settled 3.52 1/2, 3.75 higher. And July futures in the wheat pit 3.56, the high, the low at 3.52, settled 3.54 1/2. They were 2.5 cents higher. From the corn pit, the nearby September's peaked out today at 2.25 on the high, the low at 2.20, settlement price. This is September contract, by the way. 2.24, the settlement price at 2.75 higher. Once again, the September's a high today at 2.25, a low at 2.20, and a settlement price at 2.24, up 2.75. Now the December, 2.35 1/4, the high, low at 2.30, settlement price at 2.30. 244 and three quarters, 3.5 cents higher. In the March corn, 244 the high, the low at 239. Settlement price, 243 and three quarters, 3.5 cents higher. May futures up 3.25, had a high today of 249 and three quarters, a low at 245. Settled at 249 and one half for the May contract. July futures, 255 the high, the low at 250. Settled 254 and a quarter, up 3. And December for next year, 259 and three quarters, the high, the low 255 and a quarter, settled 259 and a half, up 4 cents for the day. September oats now 133 and a half, the high, the low at 130, settled 132, 2.5 higher, and December futures were up 2.5 as well, a settlement price at 140. August beans, 618 the high, the low at 598, settlement price at 609 and a half, they were up 19 and a half cents on the day. September futures 583 the high, the low at 571 and a half, settled a lot closer to the high side at 581 and a half, up 16 cents for the day. And November futures were up 14 and a quarter, 574 the high, the low at 574 and a half the high, the low at 562 and a half, and a settlement for the November beans at 571 and one quarter. Once again, they finished the day 14 and a quarter cents higher. January futures, 580 the high, the low at 569. January beans settled at 578 and a quarter. They were up 14 and a quarter as well. March contract now, 13 cents higher on the day, had a high of 586, a low at 576. Settlement price there at 583 and a half. Once again, 13 higher. And November beans for next year, 591 the high, the low at 581, settled 585 and one quarter, up 5.25 cents. August bean meal, 187.50 the high, the low at 184, settled 186.80. They finished 3 higher, and the September's 184 the high, the low at 181, settled 182.70, up 3.30. August bean oil now 22.75 the high, the low at 22, settled 22.67, 91 higher. And the September futures settled at 22.32. They were up 80. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
August feeder cattle, today's high 114.35, the low 113.25, the settlement 113.97.5, that up 22.5. September 113.15, the high 112, even the low 112.42.5, the settlement that down 12.5. October 112.60, the high 111.40, the low 111.95, the settlement that down 10. August live cattle, 84.87 and a half the high, 84.05 the low, 84.55 the settlement, that down 27 and a half. September 86.90 the high, 86 even the low, 86.90 the settlement, that up 120. October 87.80 the high, 86.75 the low, 87.40 the settlement, that down 10. August lean hog, 78.75 the high, 78.10 the low, 78.62 and a half the settlement, that up 7.5. October 70.85 the high, 69.50 the low, 70.15 the settlement, that down a nickel. December 65.70 the high, 64.80 the low, 65.42 and a half the settlement, that down 2.5. February 63.65 the high, 63.10 the low, 63.55 the settlement, that up 12.5, and August bellies 102.27.5 the high, $100.75 the low, the settlement 101.97 and a half, that up 270. The Dow.